DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Elizabeth Cantor, who is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to English and American Literature and an editor for Reganary Publishing. She earned her PhD in English from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a master's in philosophy from the Catholic University of America. Elizabeth has taught English literature, served as the editor of a book club, and written for publications ranging from National Review Online to the Boston Globe. With Elizabeth Cantor, we go inside the pages of The Jane Austen Guide to Happily Ever After, published by Reganary. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me.
I am really excited to be talking to you today.
Well, I think I'm more excited because I love this book, The Jane Austen Guide to Happily Ever After. Thank you so much for writing it.
Well, I'm just excited to be able to talk to women about an alternative to the kind of love life that is sort of available now in the 21st century.
And I'm so glad that you used Jane Austen and her wisdom. Is it just me, or even her legacy was getting twisted there for a few years?
Well, you know, I found out by just sort of getting out there and talking about Jane Austen, that there is something of a tendency to think that maybe Jane Austen is about escaping into some kind of fantasy about Mr. Darcy's smoldering good looks, you know, in kind of a romance novel cheapening of the Jane Austen reality. And Jane Austen is just so much more than that, really. If you look at Pride and Prejudice itself, then you see that actually the relationship between Elizabeth and Darcy is about getting away from, kind of like living in a fantasy or seeing things with blinders on. You know, the way Elizabeth does with Wickham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's anybody in Pride and Prejudice who's her soulmate, it's actually Wickham. They get along like house on fire at first. They're just the same kind of people. He's more her fantasy date than Darcy is, actually. And the love affair with Darcy is really about, both of them kind of stepping up their game, realizing that what they fantasize about is not as good as, you know, a person of real character. And it's the same for Darcy. For Darcy, the first time he proposes to her, he thinks he's passionate about her, but he thinks he's kind of slumming. he doesn't really approve of her family. So he proposes to her in this sort of insulting way, saying, "Well, my passion has overcome all my rational judgment and almost my conscience, and I'm." You know, essentially, I've got a crush on you against my better judgment. And she turns him down flat because, of course, that's not how you ought to love a woman at all. And it's only when they both kind of get out of this cheap kind of love, the kind of romance novel sort of thing, and learn to admire each other as human beings, that he gets to a point where he says, that he has finally met a woman who's worthy of being pleased. That, you know, somebody has to really step up his game in order to win.
Well, what's so wonderful about Jane Austen is that she provides balance, that there is this balance between the ability to be able to reason and think and your emotion. I mean, she doesn't discount emotions completely, but she also includes the fact that you can use your intellect, you can, no matter what your state in life, to be able to see things clearly and to control yourself.
Absolutely. Jane Austen is all about balance. One way to look at this is to kind of look at it in a historical way. I mean, Jane Austen was born in 1775, so she's kind of got an 18th century mindset about stuff, which I would describe as ambitiously realistic. You know, she sees things really straight, but she's not cynical like modern people sometimes are. she thinks it's quite possible for women to really achieve happiness and love and for relationships to be on a really high plane. It's a very unfamiliar way to think about relationships because we are used to kind of a romantic with a capital R mm-hmm. way of thinking about things, which is all about extremes rather than balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this idea that, which we get from the radio and from the movies we watch, that love ought to be this thing that is irrational, that's all about intensity. And then, I mean, that's really sort of like a romantic idea that came along during Jane Austen's lifetime. And really ever since, for the last 200 years, we've been kind of ricocheting back and forth between that romantic, follow your bliss, don't apply your prudence to anything, you know, on the one hand, and then the kind of all the Victorian and neo-Victorian attempts to squelch that because, of course, it leads to disaster.
Mm.
But neither one of those alternatives is really all that satisfying.
No, they're not. And there is a perfect quote in your book that Jane Austen flourished at the precise time in history perfectly suited to her special talents. Her inborn genius met a key cultural moment and produced a masterpiece. And masterpieces are those things, legacies that are left to us that can continue to teach us about ourselves today.
Yeah, I mean, the obviously Jane Austen is a genius, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's why she's sort of like number one on the classics we still love 200 years later list.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't just talented. She was also really at the high point of this long historical development of love and marriage. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, women in Jane Austen's day are getting to marry for love. That hasn't always been true in world history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, marriage used to be about family arrangements and property settlements and those kind of things. And love, a lot of times, you know, for many hundreds of years of world history, was a lot of time about adulterous affairs. And, you know, so Jane Austen is living at this really exciting time when the love and marriage have really come together, and the ideal to a certain extent of the whole society, but particularly she just refines it to this point of perfection in her book, is getting married for love, but with prudence. You know, young women themselves applying those kind of rational standards that, say, parents used to have before about, you know, is this, not just is this guy a smoldering romance novel hero, but is he somebody I can trust? Is he somebody I can depend on for my whole life?
As you say, it's a love without humiliation. And that is something that, it's sad to say that women in our culture, especially the young, all you have to do is watch a few of the reality shows that are out there to see what is being touted as what you have to do to get your guy. And it is. It's all about the lack of dignity. And they don't even realize it. They're humiliating themselves. They don't even grasp that that's happening.
Yeah, you know, I think that's becoming clearer to women, that some of the empowerment we were sold, you know, the piece of it which was like, it's empowering to have no sexual boundaries at all,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that may not be really as empowering as it was sold to us. I mean, do you remember that on Sex and the City, they had this question, you know, can a woman have sex like a man?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning like the kind of most callous play, the worst kind of man, you know,
mm-hmm.
Who has sex with people and doesn't care about them at all. I think, I mean, even if you look at, you know, the kind of change from the show that's supposed to be the new Sex in the City, this is one called Girls. I don't know. Have you heard about it?
Mm-hmm.
On HBO, right? And
yeah,
I'm boycotting it, but I read the publicity material.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some horrible, sad things in the show, according to the little clips that I saw. But I do think there's a kind of a realization that this is not dignified or really what we want. I mean, even the kind of catchphrase about the show that it's about the assorted humiliations of, you know, of these 20-something women in New York gets to this feeling that I think a lot of women have that, you know, does it really have to be like this?
Mm-hmm. The book is so profound in so many ways, Elizabeth, because, again, it's a great guide for women today as far as how to even to look at men. How, what is it that we should be searching for in, as you said, not necessarily the soulmate, but the guidelines on how to pick guys. Jane Austen has given us great guidelines.
Yes, she really has. I mean, that's the thing that I really try to get at in the Jane Austen guide is, you know, first of all, to look at, you know, what's so attractive about Jane Austen's world, what she got to offer that's hard for us mm-hmm. to find. And I think one of those things is this idea that we're supposed to be vetting guys. You know, I mean, just even that idea that we're supposed to be judging them on their character, you know, just switching over from thinking, I'm expecting to accidentally happen on the one who's going to change my life, you know, switching from that kind of romantic mm-hmm. idea that it's all going to happen because you just get struck by lightning, you know, over to the really wise, savvy idea that Jane Austen heroines have that, no, you're supposed to look at the guy and see whether you can, you know, in the old-fashioned language, whether you can esteem him or not. mm-hmm. or not. And then when you get into Jane Austen some more, I mean, I've got a chapters in the Jane Austen guide that sort of set out the actual criteria that her heroines use, the kind of checklist they've got in their minds. You know, is this a decent guy or is this person a jerk?
Throughout the book, there are all the different tips that you give us. And I think one of that stands out for me, but man bashing is beneath a Jane Austen heroine's. And that is what we see so prevalent today. It's so easy. I mean, even wives do it to their husbands when they're with their girlfriends. It's brought our culture down to an even lower level than we should allow it to be.
Yeah, it is. And really doing the research for this book, I discovered even more than I had guessed before about there is really a lot of hostility between the sexes out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's understandable because the way men and women treat each other today, kind of mutually using each other, you know, mm-hmm. they're both really doing nasty things to each other, and naturally they're both really mad, you know. So, I mean, women feel really bitter about men, and men feel really resentful and angry about women. And, you know, if you, that's one of the things that's so refreshing about reading Jane Austen is, Her heroines, they're not, you know, they're not like wearing rose-colored glasses about guys. They've got a very clear idea about, you know, what are the kind of typical aggravating ways men can behave, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Persuasion, when, you know, Anne Elliot and Captain Wentworth are very happy at the end of the book, but he's kind of complaining about how he was in suspense, not knowing whether he was going to find out if she loved him or not for something like 6 weeks, you know,
mm-hmm.
and how terrible this was for him. And, of course, she had the same experience, only she had it for about 7 years, you know. I mean, just sort of that thing where guys kind of, like, don't get the real emotional situation. They're a little bit clumsy about that,
mm-hmm.
about, you know, appreciating your feelings.
Right.
So, I mean, and Jane Austen, you know, she can gently laugh at that. But she can do it without making Captain Wentworth look like one of those stupid sitcom dads who's wrong about everything,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that respect, genuine respect for men, which is, it's a realistic respect, it's not illusioned or anything like that, but genuine respect for men is partly why Jane Austen heroines have an easier time getting genuine respect from men of themselves. You know, I mean, that we need to get back to that kind of mutual, an attitude of mutual respect, compassion of each other.
Each character, she allows them, I keep going back to that word dignity. I mean, you laugh at them, you laugh with them, but yeah. They're always presented in such a way that there's a kindness. Can I say that about, you know, it even helps you to be able to look in their flaws and yet see something good.
Yeah, Jane Austen has such a really generous attitude toward, I mean, again, you know, she doesn't have blinders on,
mm-hmm.
But there is a generosity there. There really is. And I think just her sort of, I mean, so many things about her, her judgment, her generosity, her, you know, they're just gifts to us. And again, that's what I've tried to do in the Jane Austen Guide is look at these novels that everybody loves, but distill the things that could be advice or patterns or models that we can actually change our lives with.
Why do you suppose women who have analyzed her work recently, maybe say like in the last 10, 15 years, have missed those qualities? Why do they feel that she somehow represents today's women instead of being something that today's women could aspire to? Does that make sense?
You know, that's an interesting thing. I mean, if you, especially if you're kind of in the academic world, then you'll hear all this stuff about how Jane Austen was really very subversive, you know, trying to make her out to be a modern feminist, which is kind of, well, essentially nonsense. You know, I think it's partly, I think that's part of it is that, I mean, modern women have bought into, you know, it's all part of this romantic liberationism, you know, that being free really means, you know, throwing out all rules of every kind. You know, so when Jane Austen seems to be an independent thinker or, you know, then she it seems like, oh, well, that must be feminism, you know. But I think her idea of being free and being liberated and being empowered is actually really different. I mean, especially if you look at Jane Austen's ideas about men and women and how they're different from each other. Jane Austen is just really clear that especially when it comes to attachments and relationships, men and women, there's a lot of really important differences between men and women. I mean, consider how much easier it is for us to, like, attach or, you know, get stuck on a guy than it is, you know, like Mr. Darcy says, a lady's imagination is very rapid. It jumps from admiration to love, from love to matrimony in a moment. you know, and I know, I mean, there's a story about a modern woman that I put into the Jane Austen Guide who had too much to drink on her first date with a guy she had been friends with and just kind of blurted out that he was the man she was going to marry. I mean, how embarrassing. Ouch, you know. But, I mean, I just don't know a lot of guys who are thinking, who are leaping to fantasize about their wedding suit. You know what I mean? I mean, there are real different, and Jane Austen recognizes those differences. But she doesn't see them quite the same way modern people do because, well, she actually thinks of women as being the relationship experts. You know, the ones who can explain these things to the guys. The ones whose idea about this all is likely to be more solid, you know? So, which I always say actually makes sense because, you know, we're the ones who, if we, even at the beginning of a relationship, we're thinking, is it going to be long-term or not? You know, to enjoy being with a guy, we have to kind of freight the whole thing with future expectations, you know? And in any other area of life, the people who are considering how what they're doing right now affects the future are the smart ones. I mean, people who, like when it comes to school or career or your money, you know, the people who are thinking, my choices today, what's the effect of that for 20 years from now? Those are the smart people, right? And, you know, in Jane Austen, it's women who are the smart people about relationships because they're the ones who are thinking ahead like that. The trick is, you know, men and women think so differently about relationships. How can they happily come together? And Jane Austen's idea of how we can happily come together with a guy is kind of the opposite of that Sex and the City idea that I mentioned about how, you know, the idea of women having sex like players. In other words, instead of us emulating the worst kind of men and lowering our standards to kind of be callous users of people, you know, Jane Austen expects, and her heroines expect, for men to really step up their game and, you know, feel like they don't really have a right to approach a woman in a you know, with less than a serious love for her. You know, it's all about how can a man get to the point where he is really in love like a woman.
Mm-hmm. And she does in her writing teach us through the experiences of females who may not have made the right choices. You know, like Charlotte Lucas, for example.
Yeah,
Pride and Prejudice. Yeah, poor Charlotte. If you watch the movie, you don't even appreciate what Charlotte Lucas went through until you, I mean, you really owe it to yourself to read the books. But there's an example. I mean, she teaches us through the collapse of the lives of those who did not maintain that balance in their decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, in the Jane Austen Guide, I try to show, okay, this is how the heroines are going about this, and this is how their lives end up. And then, sadly, this is how, for example, Charlotte Lucas, who ends up married to that awful Mr. Collins, she cannot even stand to be in the same room with him, really. She arranges her whole house so that, you know, he's more likely to spend the whole day away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she ends up like that because she's got it in her head that she says she only wants a comfortable home. In other words, she's willing to kind of sell herself for financial security.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think we still do this today. I mean, not just the, you know, those of us who are like famous on TV for marrying for money, but I think we sometimes just cling to a guy because he's like a security blanket. Which is just not really fair to him because, you know, he probably wouldn't be sticking with you unless he was convinced that you actually had feelings for him, you know? And that's just one kind of distraction that, you know, that I want the security and you can forget about what real love and happiness are about. I mean, there's also the Lydia Bennet example in the same, you know, also in Pride and Prejudice, where her distraction is just all about male attention. You know, a rage for admiration, as Jane Austen says. And, I mean, obviously, if you've seen the cover of Cosmo, you've seen at the checkout counter at the grocery store, you've seen women are still making that mistake of just, you know, being so hungry to get a guy's attention, however temporarily, that they've forgotten about happiness and love in the big picture.
Yeah, we see more Lydia Bennets than we see anything else these days.
I think so. It does.
Mm-hmm.
It does. I mean, again, although, you know, it may be that it's kind of like we see more of them because, you know, that's what certain media features.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, we don't have to, you know, that's the thing is, you know, women buy Cosmo, but they also still watch Jane Austen movies.
They do. I think because there is that ache in our hearts to what is it they know that we can learn from. And I think it's important, don't you think, Elizabeth, that you read the books?
Yeah.
They are absolutely delightful reads. They hold up, don't they?
They really do. And I tell you, one of the most satisfying things about having, you know, I've written and published the Jane Austen Guide to Happily Ever After is people read it and then they say, you know, they read my book and then they say, oh, I have to go read Pride and Prejudice again. Or, I really want to read Northanger Abbey. I mean, it's an advice book, but in practice, it is sending people back to the books themselves. So I'm proud of that.
They are wonderful reads that we need to go back and to hone. And yours is a wonderful way of entering into those characters. I mean, maybe people have read them years ago. Go back again, because it's sad that, unfortunately, today's quote-unquote Regency novels that are out there and actually do sell for a $20, $30 book sometimes in hardcover, they're such a waste. I mean, and you see it, and it doesn't reflect or it doesn't even do justice to the way that Jane Austen would write, you know, even about the characters.
No, they're definitely cheap imitations. she's the real thing. She's absolutely the real thing, and just full of things that can help us today. That's what I'm completely convinced of. That she's got this different idea of female empowerment that can really change people's lives.
Yeah, we're talking to Elizabeth Cantor about her book, The Jane Austen Guide to Happily Ever After, which would be perfect, not only for individual reads, but it would be great for book groups and reading clubs, because there's so much discussion. What's great about this book, Elizabeth, is that it does change your paradigm 180 degrees.
Well, thanks for saying so many nice things about the book.
Well, it's easy.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. What I'm passionate about is trying to get the word out to women. There is a different way to live. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a different way to approach your relationships. And Jane Austen can be the way you start to really change your life.
Mm, well said. Well, any final thoughts?
Just again, I'd like to reiterate that Jane Austen is so wise. She's so smart about these things. We can really trust her.
That's right. She's a voice from the past who speaks today, and she can guide us in so many different ways. I'm so glad that you brought this book forward.
Thanks so much.
Elizabeth, thank you so much. With Elizabeth Cantor, we've gone inside the pages of The Jane Austen Guide to Happily Ever After. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Reganary.com, the website for its publisher, Reganary Publishing. To hear and or download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.